Well, thank you, thank you. That's Sonny Red with Bluesville. Sonny Red, of course, on alto sax, Wynton Kelly on piano, Paul Chambers on double bass, and Roy Brooks on drums. This is Lead Stories. I'm Nutrice Lead. It is Thursday, June the 6th, and a program I hope will bring us even closer to some of the issues that we have been discussing on an ongoing basis. By the end of the month, the U.S. Supreme Court is expected to issue rulings on several controversial cases that raise major constitutional questions. We'll be taking a look at the cases pertaining to voting rights, affirmative action, and reasonable searches and seizures. And that is in the second half of the program. But first, a controversy, and some say a test case in itself, in the making, and it concerns a top priority item for the Obama administration, and that is immigration reform. Dr. Stephen Camerota is the director of research for the Center for Immigration Studies in Washington, D.C. It examines the consequences of legal and illegal immigration on the United States, and in recent years, Dr. Camerota has testified before Congress more than most any other non-governmental expert on the economic and fiscal impact on immigration. Thank you for joining us today, Dr. Camerota.
Well, thank you for having me.
Thanks so much. Now, a study conducted by the center is now at the heart of mounting opposition, albeit from Republicans principally, as the House comes up with its version of the Senate bill on immigration reform. Essentially, where does this study by the center differ from some of the main themes in the Senate bill?
Well, I should point out the Senate puts out a lot of research and a lot of studies. Which particular study are you referring to?
We're talking about the study that informed the pending legislation in the Senate, and even the one that informs the bill that is being concocted by the House.
Well, we've put out a lot of research on that. Perhaps I think maybe the thing is that you might be referring to is this new report we put out on the very large increases in the number of guest workers that
yes.
Senate bill puts out. And it's very substantial. It looks like it's going to roughly double the number of guest workers allowed into the United States each year. So that could be a potentially very large impact. It looks like it's going to be admitting about 1.6 million more temporary workers in the various seasonal and non-seasonal categories than under the current bill.
Let's deal with that. From your perspective, what is the fiscal impact likely to be by the sudden influx as conceived now? The idea is to there are 11.5 million undocumented workers. The idea is to undocumented people, I should say, including workers. The idea is to get them on the path, as I said, to citizenship, which means at some point there will be a sudden influx. What is your argument about the sudden influx?
Oh, okay. Well, there are several different issues. The Senate bill, remember, does lots of things. One is it promises to enforce the law in the future, and we could talk about that. But the other thing is it legalizes everyone here who's illegally. And then eventually those individuals get green, driver's license, social security numbers, things like that, travel documents so they can travel to and from the United States and so forth. They get that immediately after the bill passes, but then they have to wait a number of years before they get what might be called a full green card, and then after that, eventual citizenship. But they can live and work and travel and do everything they want in the United States basically immediately. The legalization or the amnesty, whichever you want to call it, happens right away. So that's part of the bill, and there's 11 to 12 million people who will benefit from that. The bill also increases significantly the number of people allowed in on a permanent basis in the future, not including that 11, 12 million illegals, from about 1 million a year to about 2 million a year. This is the so-called green card, where you can live and work in the United States as long as you wish and eventually become a citizen after a few years. So it legalizes folks. It increases permanent immigration. On top of that, it increases temporary immigration. This is foreign workers, you know, all the different categories we have, H-1B, H-2A, H-2B, H-4, U, V, J-1, J, all those temporary worker categories that have letters attached to them for high-tech, for low-tech, for seasonal agriculture, for seasonal non-agriculture. So it dramatically increases those as well. So it has lots of features to it. So big increases in permanent and temporary immigration in addition to legalizing the illegal immigrants. The concern is that all of that at a time when unemployment and non-work are at record levels, at a time when there's been very little or no wage growth, and the long-term trend, for specifically for people at the bottom end of the labor market, is a decline in wages, it just doesn't make that much sense. Even if you really want to legalize folks, the idea that we should dramatically increase permanent immigration and temporary worker programs as well just seems hard to reconcile with the realities of the U.S. labor market.
But would you be less uncomfortable about it if the profile or the general profile of the immigrant pool were different? If they were, rich, if they were able to generate jobs, if they came to start businesses as opposed to people who would more than likely be at a lower level in terms of education or in terms of the ability to make money right away?
Well, most immigrants do come to work. It's important to understand. But, as you might guess, and you suggest this, if people come to the United States with not a lot of education, then in the modern American economy, they don't tend to make very much. So they don't pay that much in taxes, even when they're paid on the books. And they also, at the same time, tend to use a lot in public services. So if you looked at households headed by immigrants that don't have a high school education, and that does make up a fair number of our immigrants, about 59% of those households use one of the major welfare programs. For households all headed by an immigrant that has only a high school education, then you're looking around 43% use one of the major welfare programs. However, households headed by, say, an immigrant with some college or especially a college degree or more, then they'd have relatively low rates of welfare use. So yes, there are important fiscal implications, just as you common sense would suggest, about allowing in less educated immigrants, even though most of them work. Because of their education levels and the realities of the U.S. economy, they are very often their U.S.-born children are eligible for a host of welfare and other means-tested programs. The other concern about unskilled immigration is that we all have a terrible situation going on at the bottom end of our labor market. If you look at people who don't have a high school education or Americans with just a high school education, their real wages, adjusted for inflation, have declined very significantly over the last three decades. And if you look at the fraction holding a job who are of working age, and so they should be working, there's just a precipitous decline over the last three decades in the share working. So they work less, they make less, they get fewer benefits. And what this bill does is add a whole lot more workers to the bottom end of the labor market. So there are very serious fiscal concerns, but there's also, does it make sense to make the native-born working poor and the native-born less educated face even more job competition? And I think that even if you favor legalizing the illegal immigrants, these big increases that I've been talking about in permanent immigration and in temporary immigration, it's very hard to make sense of that. And a lot of those increases are at the bottom end. So we accelerate family immigration. We create a new category for permanent unskilled immigration. We have new categories for temporary unskilled immigration to take work in, you know, seasonal work, but as well as permanent work. And I think it's very hard to justify that. I think it's very problematic.
So in your view, is this immigration reform, is it being rushed? Is it carefully studied, you think? Has it been given enough analysis to see exactly how immigration at this particular time in the United States and around the world, including the other nations in the world, is this the right time to basically go through a massive influx, or should, in you, is it your opinion that it should be more controlled? What is your position on that?
Yeah, I look at the government's data on wages and the government's data on employment rates and all the people who've given up looking for jobs and that sort of thing, and none of it supports the idea that we're desperately short of workers, which is the whole justification for these big increases in legal immigration that I've been, you know, discussing. So my take on it is, no, we don't need a huge influx of foreign workers. You can't, especially at the bottom end of the labor market. If you bring in lots of workers who have a college degree, well, that may well adversely affect the native-born population with a college degree, and that might be a reason not to do it. But the workers who would be affected by that higher skilled immigration have a lot more opportunities. They earn higher wages and so forth. But it's extremely hard to make that justification for those at the bottom end of the labor market. They make less than, they never made very much to begin with, and now they make less. And also they work less than they used to, and they get fewer benefits, and they have longer bouts of unemployment and so forth. So to my mind, no, it doesn't make sense to have this big influx right now. On the larger question, or the other question about process, have we given these questions ample consideration? I would argue passionately that we have not. Remember, this bill is now 1,000 pages long, and it's almost as long as the New Testament in the Bible. To digest that, it is. It's close to 160,000 words now, this new version. So to think about that for a minute and all the things in it, and I could go through and point out some particularly ridiculous aspects of the bill, but just imagine, nobody can read all that. Nobody can know what's all in all that. And that's just not a way to make public policy. Maybe a way to sort of start incrementally would be, look, let's have an amnesty, a legalization, for people who came to the United States at young ages. It wasn't their fault, but at the same time, let's get rid of the ridiculous visa lottery, which gives out visas just based on people who basically mail a postcard in, and we'll have enforcement. We'll require employers to verify the legal status of their workers. Those kinds of, you know, a small bill like that, and we find that that works, or we have to adjust it. Okay, and then we'll maybe move on to other issues. Do we really need more workers in some sectors, or are there plenty of workers, and we just have to match up the employers with the employees that are already here, and those kinds of questions. But the idea that you're going to pass a bill that's 1,000 pages long with, you know, literally dozens of provisions, no, really, many, you know, hundreds of provisions, simply doesn't make sense. Congress isn't good at it. We're not good at implementing that, and past experience with these massive bills should really give us pause.
Well, I have to come to a very disturbing aspect of this bill, and that is the issue of race. I have commented on this program that I think this whole issue of immigration reform has been racialized to the point where if you were doing word association and you say immigration reform, the word associated with it would be Mexican from the way it is going. And that is quite troubling because it seems that that particular ethnic group is being held up as a kind of shield to get a lot of very unprincipled things done and not necessarily to the benefit of the Mexican-American community. To what degree? And we're in political season. We are in a political season. Next year, we have midterm elections. This might be a way if this bill were rushed through and had gotten a lot of political support in both houses. We have a brand new pool of basically registered voters to be had. So to what degree is this whole issue of immigration reform, does it disturb you that it is so purposefully identified with the Mexican-American, quote, problem, unquote? I find that very disturbing. I find it very offensive.
Well, it is important always to remember that about the government estimates, and I think they're right, that 59-60% of all illegal immigrants in the United States, somewhere around 6 million, come from one country, Mexico. Of all illegal immigrants in the United States, the government and the Pew Hispanic Center and others, about 3/4 or 80% come from Latin America. So if you're talking about illegal immigration to the United States, Mexico and Latin America comprise much of the story, so it's natural that, you know, we would talk a lot about that. There are certainly are illegal immigrants from places like Europe, but as best we can tell, they're only between 3-5% of the total. Sub-Saharan Africa and Europe just don't make up a very large share. Most illegal immigrants are Mexican and Latin American, and then there's some East Asian and some South Asian and a few Middle Easterners. But basically, illegal immigration is mostly a Latin American phenomenon. So there's that. Now, obviously, if people are legalized now, they're not going to be able to vote in the next election. But it is true that the legalization will have political implications down the road, and the general effect will be to increase the number of voters who are inclined to support the Democratic Party. In effect, that is one of the main reasons the Democrats in Congress are so sympathetic to immigration generally, and it's why they generally overlook the impact on schools in urban areas and the challenges that immigration creates, or the job competition issue, or the competition generally for scarce public resources. Normally, the Democratic Party would be concerned about impacts on less educated and lower-income Americans, but in this case, they're not, because partly because they think their political future is being secured by immigration, legal immigration as well as amnesty. The Republican Party, you might guess, would be more anxious about increasing the number of voters who are not likely to vote for them, but the Republican Party is very captive to interests in the business community who see the immigrants in terms of labor inputs, workers. And it helps hold down wages and things like that by just increasing the supply of workers, regardless of legal status. And so the Republican Party has generally also been in favor of expansive immigration, and that's why a lot of Republicans back legalizing illegal immigrants. They see, again, they want access to the labor. That's why they – and but it is true that part of the trade-off in the bill is that the Democrats who really want the amnesty get that in this bill, and the Republicans who want big increases in guest worker programs and green card workers – that's the permanent worker programs you know, they get that, and that's sort of the trade-off. Whether any of this is actually in the interest of the American people or low-income workers who face the job competition and competition for scarce public resources, that's a completely separate question. But both parties, generally for very different reasons, have been very supportive of lots of immigration.
But I want to just extend that question a little further. And according to the Department of Homeland Security, the five top sender nations are Mexico, China, India, the Philippines, the Dominican Republic. If you lump them all together, this is a largely non-European or non-white group that would comprise the influx of new citizens or new permanent residents or new immigrants. And some can't help but see the timing of all of this, that the great hullabaloo uproar about now dealing with the immigration problem. It was a problem before, but it wasn't dealt with such a sense of urgency before, when the population coming in was predominantly white.
Well, historically, I would say that that's probably not quite right, but there was an ethnic element to it. In the 1800s, between 1880 and 1920 is the last great wave of immigration. That wave was different than the previous great waves because it was predominantly Eastern and Southern European, and the United States population was mostly Central and Western European in ancestry. At the time, it was mostly British Isles, German, Scandinavian, and that sort of thing, with a large African-American component as well. At the time, the immigrants coming in from Italy and Greece and the Russian Empire, there was concerns about their assimilation. There was also a lot of concerns about their job competition. Most historians feel, for example, that one of the groups that was most negatively affected by immigration at the turn of the last century were probably African Americans. It's only after the cessation of European immigration in the 1920s, well, first World War I in 1914, and then restrictive legislation in the 20s, after that is when African Americans mainly leave the South and come North and begin to get the better paying industrial jobs, even though very often they may have been the last hired and the first fired. Nonetheless, there's a very substantial growth in the black middle class, or at least in the black lower middle class, as a consequence of the migration North. That's why so many people came. There were other reasons as well. Then we had a period of much lower immigration for about 50 years. Partly, but only partly, as a result of changes in immigration law in the 1960s, as well as subsequent changes in immigration law and the massive growth in illegal immigration, the foreign-born population went from about 1 out of every 21 U.S. residents, or 1 out of every 20 residents, now it's about 1 out of every 8 U.S. residents. Or, if you like percentages, it went from about 4.7% of the population to about 12.9% of the population. So the foreign-born share increased by 2.5-fold. The number of immigrants went from about 10 million in 1970 to about 40, 42 million today. So that's why immigration became a much bigger deal. And when that explosion of immigration happened, a very large fraction, maybe a fourth or a third, is illegally in the country. So that's why it became a big deal. So European immigration had largely fallen off as a result of changes in the law and just general trends in Europe. And then we changed the law and we got a big influx, but most of the post-1965 immigrants, as you rightly point out, have not been from Europe. But it would be wrong to say that when the immigrants came from Europe, there was no concerns about issues like job competition and assimilation. And earlier, when large-scale German immigration started in the 1800s, or actually in the 1700s, the largely English and British Isles composition of the U.S. population, there were concerns about the German immigrants. So there was an ethnic component to it, but there's always been that concern, and there's always been the economic concern. Some people
absolutely
feel that the economic...
Absolutely.
Anyway, go ahead.
But at, so this, just, at the same time, this influx is coming along. This potential influx is happening just as the forecast for the United States in terms of ethnicity and great changes in ethnicity are occurring at the same time. So the reasoning might be that bringing in this large number of people would simply accelerate the process when whites become a numerical minority in the United States.
Right. Well, actually, probably the best way to think about it is it's the immigration that created the whole thing in the first place, right? Because in 1960, Hispanics were about 2 or 3% of the population, and today they're 17 or 18% of the population. That growth was not almost at all driven by natural increase. If there had been no immigration after 1960, Hispanics may be 4% of the U.S. population, not 17% of the population. Going forward, however, a very large fraction is natural increase. Hispanics tend to have somewhat larger families, especially the immigrant generation. But how large a fraction of the U.S. population they will ultimately be obviously depends on their fertility in the future, how many kids they have, but also future immigration. If immigration was a lot lower, then Hispanics would be a smaller fraction of the population, though they'd be growing. African Americans are much more flat in this period. They're around 12% of the population today. They're not projected to increase very much. There are black immigrants coming into the United States, but black fertility isn't that high, and the immigrants aren't that numerous. So what happens for African Americans, they roughly stay average. Asian immigration grows very rapidly as a result of immigration. In 1960, Asians were less than 1% of the U.S. population. They'd say they're about 4-4.5% of the population, so about a 400% increase. But again, that is almost entirely driven by immigration, and the changes that will come in the future is largely or significantly driven by immigration as well. But natural increase will play a very powerful role as well. So we've changed our population's demography, assuming anyone thinks that's important, but through past immigration as a result of laws we've changed over the last 40 years, and then continued immigration will continue that process, assuming we don't, you know, change it.
One last question. If you were to advise the Congress right now, What would you tell them about this? These bills that they're contemplating passing?
Well, I testify a lot.
Just say stop.
As you indicated, I do testify a lot. The one thing I would say that strikes me the most is when you're out in the real world or when you're looking at government data, the one thing you conclude is we've got plenty of workers. Wages haven't been going up. If we didn't have a lot of workers, wages would be going up very fast as employers try desperately to get more workers. That's not happening. The share of Americans who say they'd like to work but can't work is at record highs. The share of Americans who's completely withdrawn from the labor market is at record highs. So we have a kind of dismal economic picture for most American workers, especially at the bottom end of the labor market. And what I don't understand is, but when I'm in those hearing rooms with senators or members of the House, it's the only place in America where there's no workers. It's the only place where everyone says, we need more workers. There's just not enough workers. I don't understand it. I say, look, here's what I say to them, and this is what I did say. Every piece of data the government collects shows we've got too many workers. The only piece of evidence that we are short of workers is testimonials from owners of businesses that want to hire more immigrant workers. And that is the one thing you folks seem to listen to. And that's the reality. So that's the first thing. I would urge them to listen to their constituents and not just members of the business community. I'm not saying the business community should be shut out. I'm not saying what they feel or think is irrelevant. But I am saying that is not the only thing to listen to. And it appears strongly that that is all they're listening to.
Well, I don't know how it is that you've managed to make a thing like immigration reform very interesting, but you have. So
well, thank
I
you.
Thank you so much for being with us today, and I would like to call on you again because there's a lot to discuss about this bill. As you said, more than 1,000 pages long, there's a lot to discuss about it. But thank you so much, Dr. Pemroder, for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks a lot. Well, from there, we go straight to the matter of the law and the law as interpreted by the U.S. Supreme Court. And we have an equally well-educated guide. His name is Dr. Gerald Hebert, Executive Director and Director of Litigation at the Campaign Legal Center in Washington, D.C. And we're going to be talking about some of the cases the U.S. Supreme Court has been considering and will decide by the end of the month that really impact our daily lives. Thanks, Jerry, for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you. Well, let's start with where the court has already made a decision in the case of Maryland versus King. What is significant about this ruling? And tell us a little bit about that.
Well, Maryland versus King is a case that was decided this week by the Supreme Court in a 5-4 decision, and I'll get to the alignment, which is a little unusual, in a minute. In that case, the police in Maryland used a cheek swab to take a DNA sample from somebody who had been picked up for first and second degree assault charges. And it was used, the swab, the DNA swab of his inside his cheek was used to identify him and match him to an unsolved rape that occurred 10 years ago. And he was then charged with that crime, and he moved to suppress the DNA sample, arguing that the search violated his Fourth Amendment right against an unreasonable search and seizure. And the Supreme Court reviewed that question, and what they decided was that when officers make an arrest supported by something called probable cause to hold somebody for a serious offense, and they bring that suspect to the police station to be detained in custody, that taking and analyzing a cheek swab of the arrestee's DNA is a lot like fingerprinting and photographing, which they felt was a legitimate police booking procedure and was a reasonable search under the Fourth Amendment. So that's what the court decided. Now, I said the lineup was a little unusual. You had Justice Kennedy writing the majority opinion, in which Chief Justice Roberts and then Justice Thomas, Alito, and Breyer joined. And the dissenters were three of the more liberal judges, Ginsburg, Sotomayor, and Justice Kagan, with Justice Scalia filing the dissenting opinion. And what Justice Scalia said in dissent for the four of them was that the Fourth Amendment forbids searching a person for evidence of a crime when there's no basis for believing the person is guilty of the crime or in possession of incriminating evidence, and that prohibition is universal. It's without exception. When the Supreme Court has allowed suspicionless searches, so to speak, it's insisted that there be a justifying motive apart from investigation of a crime. And one of the more humorous lines in Justice Scalia's dissenting opinion was that he said that the court's assertion that the DNA was being taken not to solve crimes but to identify those who were in the state's custody, he said, quote, taxes the credulity of the credulous, quote. And he also noted that he just thought it was not akin to fingerprinting and photographing, and for that reason they dissented.
Now, so, the slippery slope here seems to be that the swabbing can occur, one, without a warrant, and two, upon being arrested as opposed to being convicted. Is that it?
Yes. Once you're in custody, it's considered by the court to be, they said that a swab was, I think the words they used were quick and painless. It requires no surgical intrusion. It doesn't pose any safety or health threat to the arrestee. And the fact that it's an intrusion that is only minimal at best, the court said, was very important to deciding whether or not that search is reasonable. And they weighed that, an individual's right to privacy and not to be searched, against the government's right to identify arrestees, and found that the governor's interest outweighed it.
Now, we have the next case, which puts us in the affirmative action category. The case is Fisher versus University of Texas. This is to be decided. We do not have a ruling on that yet. But what is the significance of this case?
Well, this case is extremely important, but it's also unusual in the fact that the case is even before the court. What you have is 10 years ago, in 2003, when Justice O'Connor was on the court, you had the Supreme Court ruling in a case out of Michigan that, in fact, race could be a factor used by schools of higher education in admissions. And it could be a factor. And there were a lot of kind of qualifiers about it. But Justice O'Connor delivered the opinion for the court. And what she said 10 years ago was that basically that the path to leadership in our country must be visibly open to everybody, and that if you're going to have effective participation by racial and ethnic groups in our country is essential if the dream of one nation indivisible is going to be realized, or words to that effect. And she noted that universities and law schools represent the training ground for our nation's leaders. So, and she noted, you know, that most of the governors are lawyers, and half the seats in the Senate and a third of the House and so on. And she herself, you know, had been the beneficiary of an education that permitted her to go from the New Mexico-Texas area on to, and paved her way for admittance to Stanford, which kind of set the course for her adult life and successful life at that. So that was 10 years ago. And Justice O'Connor noted in her opinion that, you know, race was just one factor here, but it could be taken into account because of the compelling interest that universities had with respect to creating a diverse student body. And she noted that, you know, she didn't think this was something that should go on forever. In fact, she kind of gave us one more generation of affirmative action and said, we're going to put this in effect for 25 years. And I think by that time, we probably will have achieved, you know, the results that we need to establish this diverse population in our colleges and universities. Well, then lo and behold, a case comes out of Texas, which Texas, at the time of that decision 10 years ago in Michigan that the Supreme Court decided, Texas had already been found to have engaged in illegal affirmative action in the sense that they had used race as a factor too much. And so Texas then went to a new system, which was called the 10% system. They allowed anybody who graduated in the top 10% of their class could get into the University of Texas. And since you have, you know, inner city African American schools and a lot of inner city Latinos dominated student population schools, and then a lot of all Anglo schools, that it was felt that if they just let the 10% in from every high school, that it would create a diverse program. And so they had that system in place. And then when the decision came out in 2003, Texas modified their 10% program. They said, well, we're going to have 75% of all of our seats filled by the top 10% kids. And then all the others, we're going to have this set of factors that we're going to look at. And they had a primary set of factors, like did the person come from a socioeconomic background that was poor, and had they, you know, lifted themselves up? Had they exhibited leadership? Were they the class president below? Things that had really, didn't identify with race necessarily. Then they had some secondary criteria that had factors in it, and you would get a boost or a plus if you had certain of these factors. Do you speak a language? Did you come from a family or a background where English is not the first language spoken? Are you a racial or a minority? Things like that. And so they used that to plus up some applicants, but they were, again, applicants who had the academic skills, but they had been given extra points for being a member of a racial minority group. And so a couple of white students were recruited by people opposed to affirmative action. They called them up down in Texas, and they said, hey, we think you didn't get into the University of Texas. We think that some black students and other minority students perhaps were admitted that you had better qualifications than they did. And we'd like to sue over it. And they did. And the case is now back before the Supreme Court when, in fact, we had thought affirmative action was kind of off the table for a while. But here it is back again, and the Roberts Court has taken it up. And what I would note about it, though, is that, in cases like the affirmative action case, we're not really necessarily advancing the cause of civil rights or diversity. We're really protecting ground we had already won here in the Supreme Court. And we'll know soon enough if this case, which is known as the Fisher case, will reestablish the right for colleges and universities to take race into account as one factor, and in this case, a very subsidiary, secondary factor, or whether they're going to be barred from doing so.
Well, one of the things I just want to note before we move on to a subject very dear to your heart is that the plaintiff in the case, Abigail Fisher, did not qualify. She did not make the requisite academic marks to qualify as litigant, in my view. I don't know how that would play in the final decision by the U.S. Supreme Court. But now we move on to Shelby County versus Holder, and this is where you have a soft spot because you had yourself argued cases regarding the Voting Rights Act before the U.S. Supreme Court. Tell us how you are viewing this case.
Well, this case is perhaps the most important voting rights case that will be decided in our generation and in our lifetimes. What is at issue in this case under the Voting Rights Act is a provision of the act that requires jurisdictions in our country that have a long history of discrimination to get approval from the federal government, either the Justice Department in Washington or a special federal court in Washington, D.C., of any change that they make that affects voting. You see, back in the 50s and 60s, as blacks were starting to become registered voters, local election officials engaged in all kinds of discriminatory methods to keep them from voting or to keep them from being registered. And they were very ingenious about it, because every time the Justice Department would invest months and months and sometimes years and years to get a court order stopping them from doing whatever they were doing, they would turn around and do something different that accomplished the same result that was not part of the injunction that the court had entered. So when the Voting Rights Act was passed in 1965, Congress said, you know, we're going to say that if you change anything, that has to be approved. That way we know that we've established a floor that we will never go backwards from, that we will never go under, that it'll only be up. You can only make changes that don't discriminate and don't make black, or in the case of language minorities, Latinos and Asian Americans and Native Americans, worse off than they were before. So for years now, it's been percolating along. Many times the Justice Department or the federal court in Washington has found intentional discrimination in some cases against minorities, certainly less today than in 1965. Nobody really says that times haven't changed. But at the same time, I don't think it has changed that much in some places. And so you have about 16 states, mostly in the Deep South, that continue to have to make what are called preclearance submissions or applications to the Justice Department or federal court before they can institute their voting changes. And that has now been challenged as unconstitutional. Now, the interesting part about this case, and the part that I think from a lawyer's point of view, many of us find rather distressing, is that just 4 years ago, this exact case issue was before the Supreme Court in a case out of Texas, and the court, in an 8-1 ruling, 8-1, said that they would not declare the Voting Rights Act unconstitutional, these provisions requiring preclearance. And in fact, they interpreted the act to allow any state or local government that was subject to these rules to exempt themselves if they simply came in and submitted an application showing that they don't discriminate in the way that they offer voter registration and the way they conduct their elections. And since 2009, when the Supreme Court allowed this these states and local governments to exempt themselves, we've had a couple of hundred do so, and including an entire state, the state of New Hampshire, which was one of the states that actually got covered, not because of a long history of discrimination, but for some other reasons related to the actual formula that decided who would be covered. And now here we are 4 years later in the court again, kind of similar to the Fisher case that I described, the affirmative action case a minute ago. The case is back before the Supreme Court, and the Voting Rights Act now hangs in the balance. And from a lawyer's point of view, it's distressing for a second reason, which is, and for the American public, I think, as well, which is that when we look at the Constitution of our country, we see that the 14th and 15th Amendments, which are Civil War Reconstruction Amendments, they say that, you know, no person shall be denied the equal protection of the laws, the right to vote shall not be denied or abridged on account of race or color. And in both cases, they say the Constitution says that the Congress shall determine how to enforce these by appropriate legislation. That's the quote, appropriate legislation. And so we in our nation leave it to Congress as the elected representatives of the people to make the decisions about how to enforce these equal protection, equality requirements under our Constitution. And we do that because the Constitution says so. And if any body of government should be entrusted with the decision about when the long history of discrimination is over, it should be Congress. It shouldn't be unelected judges on the Supreme Court. And so for reasons I think that we'll see soon, whether the court is going to basically reverse the decision it made just 4 years ago upholding the act, or whether or not it's going to strike it down. And I will tell you, just from since I represent a lot of state and local governments, and I'm pretty attuned, I think, to what is going on in various legislatures, I think that if the court strikes down the act, the provisions that apply to these 16 states, you'll see many voting changes taking place that will make minority voters a lot worse off, some of them intentionally discriminatory, and the court will have opened a floodgate to that. And that seems to me to be bad for a nation that holds itself as being one nation, undivided.
Well, I want to thank you for a fast overview of these cases. Certainly, when the decisions are made in the two cases that we talked about, in particular the voting rights and the affirmative action cases, I'd like to call on you again to tell us what you think the impact immediately will be.
Okay. I look forward to that. We should know, as you pointed out in the introduction today, we should know that within a few weeks.
Thank you so much, Jerry Hebert, for being with us today. I really appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you for having me on the program.
Thank you. Well, that brings us to the end of our program today, and I want to thank you for hanging in with me. Tomorrow, an exciting program, including the attorney for the Trayvon Martin's family will be doing a preview of the case, which will begin officially. We don't know. It still is up in the air because they're arguing about evidence, and we are to know by the end of the day whether a delay is going to be granted. The arguments are continuing now in court, and we'll be talking also a bit more about immigration. These are very important issues, and today I hope you got a fairly good handle on what the salient issues are and, you know, what people in the know, people who are in a position to be authoritative and expert about these things, that they share their ideas with us, and that's very, very rewarding. I want to ask you again to just make a phone call. We have this project that I want us all to participate in, and that is to advocate in behalf of children in Haiti whose relatives are beyond the point of despair about having them in their homes here in the United States. They can take care of them and their relatives by the time that Haiti is being reconstructed. Please make a call to Congresswoman Frederica Wilson at 202-225-4506 and politely and respectfully urge her to take action by calling the President of the United States and urging him to tell the Department of Homeland Security to expedite Haitian family reunification now. Everything had been approved and just ready to go. There's no cost to anything. All the appropriate agencies have signed off on this, and for some reason it just isn't happening. And if we make a call and impress upon this congresswoman, whose district has the largest number of Haitians in the United States and who should be carrying the banner on this, we want to fortify her as well. So give her a call, give her office a call, and impress upon her that you are concerned that the family reunification for Haitian children be expedited now. So with these remarks, I thank you for listening to us today, and we'll see each other tomorrow, and I really do appreciate the pleasure and privilege of your company. You can reach me, of course. You can continue the conversation at leadstories, L-E-I-D, stories, at gmail.com, or on Facebook at Lead Stories with Utrice Lead. Take care. See you tomorrow.